This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's program, Saving a Child's Heart, Israeli cardiologists treat Iraqi kids.
You know, our usual exchanges with the Iraqis were Scud missiles. The wars and the animosity is not really between the people.
Plus, filling your stomach for 50 cents in Senegal. And walking in two worlds, an Afghan exchange student living in Texas goes back to Bamyan.
I just want to be the governor of this province. The first thing I'm going to do is to make, you know, women and men equal. Equal rights between men and women.
Welcome to the World Vision Report. Little progress is being made in resolving the conflict between Arabs and Israelis. That's despite years of negotiations and many attempts at a peaceful solution. But a group of sick children has achieved what politicians have failed to do. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman, Jordan.
Iraqi parents have just arrived at the Jordanian Red Crescent Hospital in Amman. They've flown in from their war-ravaged country with their sick children. This is the last and only hope most have to save their children's lives. All of them suffer from severe heart problems. While they wait to be examined, some kids cut Valentine hearts out of colored paper and write their names on them. The Iraqi children, mainly babies and toddlers, all have their blood pressure, pulse, and other vitals measured as they await heart checkups. Not by Jordanian doctors, but by Israelis.
You know, our usual exchanges with the Iraqis were Scud missiles. The wars and the animosity is not really between the people.
That's Dr. Sion Khoury. He's an Israeli pediatrician. He and two Israeli cardiologists will examine the children today. Why do this in Jordan? The Iraqi families can't travel directly to Israel because the two countries have no official relations. But Jordan has a peace treaty with Israel, so both doctors and patients can meet here.
You know, it's very simple. We believe that Iraqi kids, like Israeli kids, like Jordanian kids, like even British kids, need care. And if we can do it, then we should do it.
The doctors serve with the Israeli organization Save a Child's Heart. The group has treated some 1,700 children from 28 countries. About half of those receiving care are Palestinians. The team isn't allowed to perform surgery in Jordan, so Dr. Khoury tells one of the mothers that if her son is to be saved, she must travel quickly to Israel. The four-year-old named Mistu has arteries that are twisted.
It is a big surgery, very dangerous, but it is doable. We've done it in the past very successfully.
It's dangerous, very bad.
Yeah, but you don't really have a choice.
You say this
complex. It is complex, it is dangerous, but yeah, we don't have a choice.
You've done this operation.
We've done it.
Yeah, like this?
We've done exactly like I told you,
yes.
Successfully.
Success.
Now, inshallah.
We want quickly to do this?
We need to do this quickly. Yes, we need to do this. Should have been done a few years ago, so we should do it as soon as we can.
The Kurdish woman won't give her name. For her family's safety in Iraq, it's best she not be identified. She says militants there would surely kill them for seeking help from Israelis. She explains in Arabic.
We can't say anything about this, especially in Iraq. Certainly there is fear, but my son will be healed in Israel, so I don't care about anything. I'm afraid of the terrorists in Iraq. I'm risking my life for the sake of my child, but that's not important. The important thing is that my son will be okay.
Mistu glides a red toy car given to him by volunteers. His tiny blue-tipped fingers betray his heart condition, which his mother said was misdiagnosed in Iraq shortly after birth. Inside the examination room, the Israeli doctors work feverishly to provide thorough checkups to the children. But they are working against the clock. Cardiologist Akiva Tamir says Mistu is one of the lucky Iraqi children he's seen this day that could still be treated. Others are not so fortunate.
Some of the kids are in our problem because they got here too late, that they just missed the train. In pediatric cardiology, in some of the problems, you know, the vessels of the lung become very stiff, and if you don't treat them on time, and then you cannot proceed with the operations.
Tamir said it was emotionally wrenching to have to tell some of these Iraqi parents that nothing could be done for their children.
We are very tense because we have to face things that we don't face usually. We don't see cases that are untreatable.
Abu Ahmed's daughter was successfully treated in Israel several months ago. He now helps put other Iraqi families in touch with the aid group. He even accompanies them when they travel to Jordan. Abu Ahmed, who drives a taxi, is also helping the families overcome fears about receiving help from Israeli doctors. He says the families are concerned about their children's future the way I was concerned about mine. I went to Israel for treatment, he says, not for politics. After seeing this, I feel there could be peace. For the World Vision Report, I'm Dale Gavlak in Amman, Jordan.
Food prices have spiraled out of reach across the globe. The price of grain, a staple in many developing countries, has risen recently by more than 80%. People are taking to the streets to express their anger in places like Haiti, Egypt, and Bangladesh. And riots last month in Senegal shook that normally peaceful country. One of our reporters was in Senegal recently, and she met a woman named Astu Jaw who has found a way to feed people for less than a dollar a day. In downtown Dakar, a dollar doesn't go very far. Astu Jaw runs a food stall there that's become a kind of community kitchen. Phung Tran has more from Dakar, Senegal.
Before the sun rises, 47-year-old Astu Jaw and her 16-year-old daughter, Johnny, ride a bus through Dakar's faintly lit streets to get to her corner breakfast stand. She's been selling bean-filled baguettes and coffee there for 4 years.
I wanted to help out my husband and our 7 kids. It is hard work, and sometimes I cannot cover my costs. But even though it is really hard, I still am able to help out more than before.
It takes Astu Jaw and her daughter 10 minutes to get to the aluminum-sided, cardboard-roofed food stand. It's across the street from her husband's metal shop, which also serves as her kitchen. Mother and daughter work quickly. They heat a bucket of water and stir beans over a fire that will go into her signature spicy lentil sandwich. At 2 feet long and 50 cents each, it is a bestseller. Jaw made almost $2,000 last year, almost 3 times the average annual income in Senegal. While Johnny washes glasses, Jaw fills a large silver bowl with the lentils. By 7:30, she takes her seat next to a small table for the morning rush. Mamadou Diop comes in for the local drink, a heavily sugared, frothy concoction that is a spicy mix of coffee, cloves, and pepper. He is a security guard at a government office building in the neighborhood.
I come when I have the money. Sometimes when I don't, I'll still come by and she'll sell to me on credit. I can eat good home-cooked food here. At Astu's stand, for less than 50 cents, you can be full.
Dozens of customers and 4 hours later, Jaw counts her change. She made the $6 needed to cover her expenses and $1 profit.
Mondays are the hardest because most people don't have money at the beginning of the work week. Maybe tomorrow will be better.
Folding her apron, Jaw takes one of her lentil sandwiches for her own first meal of the day and waits for the bus to go home. For the World Vision Report, I'm Phung Tran in Dakar, Senegal.
Star starving people are often driven to desperation. New York Times reporter Donald McNeil wrote an article on what starving people do to survive. He told us it was a photograph on the front page of the newspaper that caught his attention.
The story was about suffering in Haiti in the wake of fighting. And there was a photograph of biscuits made out of, that looked sort of appetizing. They were sort of swirls of white dough baking in the sun. But when you looked at the caption, it turned out that they were made out of butter, salt, and dirt. And one of my editors came to me and said, have you ever seen anything like this? Do you know the story behind these biscuits? And I'd never been to Haiti. And I said, no, I don't know anything. And then she said, look, could we do a piece on what people do all around the world when they're starving or when they're right on the verge of starvation? What do they do to cope? And that piqued my interest. And I said, sure, I'll look into it.
It's a strange story to do, isn't it? Because it's almost intriguing because it's so creative, but it's really tragic.
No, it's a horrible situation. I mean, people get on the verge of starvation and they have to turn to plants that they wouldn't have considered before, or things you might not normally think to eat, like locusts in Mozambique, like the tiny little kernels inside marula fruit that you can crack and poke out with a pin. There are also foods that people sort of eat that are somewhere between a traditional snack and somewhere between a starvation food. For instance, you can get skewers of roasted mice in Malawi. When you drive along rural roads, you'll find kids coming out of the fields with mice they've caught in the field and put on a skewer and roasted over the fire. But that's not really a starvation food. That's sort of a rural snack. When people are desperate, they do things like break into anthills or termite mounds, and they take out all the tiny grains that the ants have collected and eat those.
Now, some of the things that surprised me most in your article were that it wasn't just bushes and seeds people were eating, but they are eating non-edible things.
Chairs, for example. Well, that was a story that somebody sent me from a World Food Program worker who worked in Angola in the early 1990s. And he had seen a father who came home with a leather and wood chair and told his family that if we don't die today, we're going to be able to survive for 4 more days. And he pulled the leather off the chair and soaked it for day and a night in order to soften the leather and try to leach out the tanning chemicals. And then he boiled it and made what he called lamb soup out of it. And I spoke to a woman who said that she had heard stories about people eating furniture in the Soviet Union in the 1930s during the starving times there. You know, leather is edible under extreme circumstances.
But leather certainly isn't nutritious.
Dirt biscuits aren't nutritious either. It fills up your stomach for a while.
You had another story about Eritrean women. What do they do when they're hungry?
Eritrean women apparently strap flat stones to their stomach to try to keep the hunger pangs away. And all over the world, I've heard this story a number of times, that you will find mothers who, when the kids are hungry, will put a pot of water on the fire and drop some stones in and tell the kids that the food is cooking and it's not ready yet. It'll be a little while longer, and you just hope the kids fall asleep while they're waiting for the food to cook.
How many people are we talking about that actually have to resort to these kinds of coping mechanisms when they're hungry?
Many millions of people go to bed hungry each night. But there's a difference between going to bed hungry and going to bed starving. And unfortunately, starving is one of those things that isn't caused merely by the lack of food. I mean, one of the things I mentioned in the article is that economic historians think that since the year 1500, roughly, there has never been a famine that is caused entirely by a lack of food, by crop failure or pests. There's always been some political component to it. People have been allowed to die, and that's one of the great tragedies in the modern world, is that there always is food there. It's just sometimes people prevent it from getting to the people who need it.
Mm-hmm. Donald, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Donald McNeil writes for the New York Times. To read his article, go to our website at worldvisionreport.org. And now, our globe at a glance. Are you ready for a ride to Rwanda? That's the question mountain biker Tom Ritchie asked his bicycling friends in Cape Town, South Africa. A team set off recently on the 2,000-mile road trip north. The purpose of the trip is to raise money for coffee growers in Rwanda. It's all part of a plan called Project Rwanda to provide coffee farmers with specially modified bikes to transport their coffee beans. Part of the funds raised will go to Team Rwanda, the first national cycling team from that country. It all started in 2005, when a friend invited Richie to tour Rwanda by bike. It was 11 years after the genocide that killed almost a million people. Richie was so moved by the healing taking place in the country and the efforts at reconciliation that he decided to devote his life to assisting Rwandans. He started a grassroots racing team, and he opened a bicycle assembly factory. Richie designed a special bike to transport goods, and he established a mountain bike safari touring company. The mountain biker says he's using what he knows best, the bicycle, as a tool and symbol of hope to assist in Rwanda's economic recovery. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer, and you're listening to the World Vision Report. We've been hearing a lot about healthcare in this presidential primary season. Affordable healthcare is something people in the developing world are struggling to acquire, too. We return to Dakar, Senegal, with a report from Jordan Davis.
On a street in a Dakar suburb, women kneel over wash tubs. They laugh and sing as they rub out stains with their bare hands. Njemi Njai sells these neighborhood women bars of soap. She says she makes a profit of about 10 cents on each one.
You don't make much from it, but you can't sit and fold your hands either. There are kids to feed.
And medical expenses to pay. Those bills were especially worrisome, Njemi says, when she was about to deliver her third child.
That time was really difficult because I knew my husband didn't have any money and we were going to have a baby.
And Jemmy's husband, Umar, runs a store out of a lean-to shack selling animal feed. The Njais can keep food on the table largely because they live in a relative's home, rent-free. So Umar says while his wife was in labor, he was frantically running around to friends and relatives asking to borrow money. It was a routine he knew only too well.
I can show you past medical bills from when I didn't have money at all. It was always very embarrassing. Your wife or your child is sick and you're confronted with this huge bill and you have to go and run to get money.
Umar Njai shuffles through a stack of crinkled prescriptions he's collected over the years, reading off the prices. All of them unfilled. The $10 or $20 was simply too much. But medical care is now less of a burden for the Njai family. They recently joined a so-called micro-insurance plan. It's like a stripped-down version of an HMO in the U.S. The family pays a monthly premium of $2.50. In turn, they get 70% of the cost of hospital and doctor's visits reimbursed. For the Njai family, the plan came in handy when baby number four came along.
When my last child was born, I didn't have money. But since I was already covered, when they gave me the bill, it went straight through the health plan. It was a big help because I didn't have to pay out of pocket.
The Njai family buys this insurance plan from a nonprofit organization called Pamikas. Matunya runs the local office of Pamikas. She says in the sprawling suburbs of cities like Dakar, people don't get to see the doctor much.
We recently offered a day of free medical consultations. It was scheduled from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. We were flooded with so many people, we had to stay until 8 that night. It shows there's a real lack of access to medical care.
Pamikas has been offering the micro-insurance plan for a year now. It funds the plan with money from development agencies and the profits from its microloan programs. Pamikas hopes the insurance program will one day become self-sufficient, with enough paying customers to fully cover insurance claims. But it's been slow to catch on. Nya says at her branch, only around 80 families have signed up.
People don't believe in it yet. It's not easy to change people's mentalities. There's not really a culture yet of thinking about your health before there's a crisis. People are coming, signing up little by little.
At the Njai house, husband Umar says scraping together the family's monthly premium of $250 is a struggle.
It requires a lot of sacrifices to come up with the money.
Children in Senegal routinely come down with malaria, yellow fever, and pneumonia. So wife Njemi says whatever the sacrifice, it's worth it.
All the time you're worried about what kind of treatment they'll get. So with this insurance plan, it's a big relief.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Jordan Davis in Dakar, Senegal.
We've had Generation X, the Lost Generation, and the Greatest Generation. Now, meet Generation T. It's made up of young Afghans who grew up under the Taliban and who are now coming of age. Reporter Will Everett met one member of Generation T who's hoping to make a difference in his home country. We've changed his name in this story to protect him from the growing violence in Afghanistan. The story starts in Texas.
Ali Khan might pass as any American teenager, dressed as he is in shorts, a t-shirt, and a baseball cap. And his room is typically American, too.
So, I just couldn't clean up things. It's a little bit messy.
A packed suitcase stands on the floor. Ali's been participating in a program sponsored by the nonprofit American Councils. It enables students from Afghanistan to spend 1 year in the United States. They attend an American high school and live with an American host family. In a few days, though, Ali will be going back home to the town of Bamyan in central Afghanistan.
And in order to go to Bamyan, we have to cross this province. There are a lot of Talibans. I'm just worried about that.
It's been a year marked by firsts, going to school with girls, learning to swim, and playing basketball. He was a member of his high school basketball team until the month of Ramadan, when he had to choose between athletics and religion.
The problem was that in Islam we have this fasting month, or Ramadan. And so for me, it was hard to, you know, do fasting and also in the meantime play basketball, because you get, you know, tired and thirsty, so you need to drink. And I just quit basketball.
As he prepares to return home, he's careful not to pack souvenirs that might arouse suspicion. He'd like to bring back an American flag, but that would be dangerous. Instead, he's bringing home the flag of Texas.
If somebody stop us and then search for our luggage and stuff, if they find, you know, they probably recognize the flag of the United States. I mean, you know, if there are some bad people. But they will not notice that this is flag of Texas.
3 months later in Bamyan, Ali lights a propane stove to make breakfast. Ali rents this small room with a roommate. His home village is a long walk from here. He goes to high school but also has a part-time job in Bamyan, so he's decided to live on his own. The room is a far cry from his host's home in San Antonio. There's no heat or plumbing, and the electricity runs only a few hours a day.
That's the office.
That afternoon, Ali gives me a tour of his high school after school is let out. It's a new building with light fixtures in every room, but no electricity. We pause in Ali's classroom where he tells me about life under the Taliban.
I was 6 years old when the Taliban took over, when they came, like, in the beginning. My dad and I, we were walking one day to somebody's house. This Taliban was on their patrol. They stopped us, and then they asked some religion questions. The question basically were related to Sunni perspective. My dad answered them honestly, and he said, well, I'm a Shia, but I will answer whatever I know. And they said, that's not acceptable for us, and they just beat us.
Later, Ali takes me up a mountain that gives a view of Bamyan's biggest claim to fame, the rubble of the giant Buddha statues the Taliban blew up in 2001. Ali and his family witnessed the terrifying event from the other side of the valley.
It was a sunny day like today, and I was actually way, you know, do you see that those hills there? I was just standing right there and I was watching. There were a lot of, you know, heavy guns, and then they were just shooting at the Buddha, at their face and stuff. And then I saw that the Buddha is collapsing down, and it was, like, so sad for us. I didn't know the importance of the Buddha at that time.
As we climb another steep hill, Ali reminds me that though the Taliban have left Bamyan, the area isn't free of dangers.
All right. Be careful. There are a lot of landmines.
Landmines kill or maim about a dozen people each day in Afghanistan, part of the Taliban's legacy of terror that's still a fact of daily life here. Later that day, we pay a visit to the Bamyan orphanage where Ali does volunteer work. A number of children run outside to greet him. One of the teachers welcomes Ali with a warm handshake.
He
It's great that Ali spends time with the kids here. Our government provides food and shelter, but this country needs more volunteers like Ali, because these kids are the future of Afghanistan. Ali comes here several times a week, sometimes to help teach the kids, but more often just to play. The kids are eager to show off one of the songs Ali has taught them. In addition to his volunteer work, Ali teaches English to city employees for $250 a month. That's slightly more than his father makes as a full-time doctor. This probably makes Ali the richest 17-year-old in Bamyan. He's saving to go to college after he graduates from high school.
I really hope to go and attend college, okay, but not in Afghanistan, in the U.S. And I want to have my degree, and then I will return back to my hometown and serve my people.
He wants to study agriculture, a valuable skill in a country where much of the farming is still done with ox-drawn plows. But he sees his education as a stepping stone toward an even bigger goal.
Well, I think everybody should have a mission in their life. Without a mission, you don't know your future. I just want to be the governor of this province.
You do?
Yes, I really do. The first thing I'm going to do is to make, you know, women and men equal. Equal rights between men and women.
With conditions in Afghanistan being what they are, few Afghans who study abroad ever return to their home country. Ali admits that he had a good life back in Texas, and he knows that opportunities here are limited, even for the most educated of Afghans. Ali's roommate Khaled interrupts us to give a sample of his singing. He's hoping to immigrate to the West to become a pop singer. Ali just rolls his eyes. He says that if all of Afghanistan's talented young people leave, what will become of their country?
I'm not going to forget my people, and I will, for sure, I will be back. So I promise that. You have my promise then.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Will Everett, Bamyan, Afghanistan. La 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 la. हमको हमी से चुरा लो दिल को हमी से छुपा लो ओ न जाए.
And that brings us to the end of our show. If you want to hear more about any of our stories, please visit our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can sign up for a podcast there and listen to us on your own time. I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.